This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is David Williams. David is author of several books, including The Seattle Street Smart Naturalist, Field Notes from the City, and Karen's Messengers in Stone. David Williams is here today to tell us about his most recent book, Too High and Too Steep, Reshaping Seattle's Topography, published in 2015. Welcome, David.
Thank you, Diane. It's a pleasure to be here.
What led you to write your book, Too High and Too Steep? What is your purpose?
My purpose is to illustrate that although we think we live in a very natural city, Seattle is a surprisingly unnatural in the sense that we have reshaped the land, particularly the downtown area, so much through its history. And we started doing that as soon as the first settlers arrived. And obviously, we're still doing it to this day with things such as Bertha.
What did Seattle look like before the topological changes you speak about in your book were made?
If you think of downtown Seattle area around Pioneer Square and say down to about a little bit south of the pergola at Yesler Street, about three blocks south of there is Jackson. That was the end of the city when the first settlers arrived. And the shoreline basically ran up what is now First Street, at the time called Front Street. And then south, where the stadiums are and all the industrial complex of the city, was a big tide flat that was part of the Duwamish River. So as the Duwamish flowed into Elliott Bay, it slowed down, deposited sediments, and those sediments built up a tide flat that half the day would be covered by water and half the day would be this open mud flat that was basically unusable. So the odd thing about Seattle was in the early days, there basically was no flat land in what we think of as the sort of downtown part of the city.
What were the geological forces that had led to Seattle's original topography?
Twofold. One, the longer term is a collision between California running into Oregon, which then pushes into Seattle, a big plate tectonic issue, and Seattle being squeezed between Canada and Oregon. And that created what's known as the Seattle Fault that runs east-west across the city and made some very significant alterations to the landscape, in particular raising up Alki Point out of the water where the first settlers arrived. The other strong impact on the city was during the last ice age when there was a 3,000-foot thick glacier plowing across the landscape, depositing lots of mud and sand and gravel, and then as it moved over the landscape, acting like a large rake and scraping a series of furrows and ridges that created the topography. So when the settlers arrived, it was hill and valley, and then also this landscape with fairly soft sediment underneath. And that's going to be key for why Seattle is able to change so much.
How different is Seattle geologically from other U.S. cities?
It's very young geologically. Most of what we see in the landscape is just under 20,000 years old, meaning it's mostly glacial sediments. And it's also very soft. If you compare Seattle to a place like San Francisco, the hills of San Francisco are made of solid rock. Ours is made of relatively unconsolidated material, again, making it much easier to manipulate.
In what ways did early Seattle residents see the physical surroundings they found themselves in to be a problem? What did they see as the challenges of the city?
A couple-fold. One I alluded to earlier, there was no flat land, so that meant there was no place for an industry really to grow. And the other aspect that they were very much concerned with was bringing rail traffic into Seattle. And in order to do that, they had to cross the tide flats, which they eventually do with a train trestle. But then to go north out of Seattle, they had to extend the shoreline further into the water, push it further west to provide a place for trains. So they were concerned basically from a transportation point of view. How do you move through this very topographically challenging landscape?
Before we speak in detail about individual projects, would you give a brief overview of the changes in topography Seattleites made in the city in the early days?
The main ones I address in my book are threefold. One is filling in the Duwamish tide flats, which involved making about 2,500 acres of new land. And literally, it was taking unusable space and creating usable land out of it. The second was building the ship canal and changing Lake Washington. How it flowed and the level of the lake was very significant. And the third, and probably the most famous topographic change in Seattle were the regrades. The most famous, of course, is the Denny regrade, but there is also regrading of Jackson Street and Dearborn, each of which basically lowered a hill by anywhere between 80 and 100 feet.
To what extent is Seattle the same and or different from other cities in altering the topography of the surrounding area?
The way it's very similar is this idea of making land. And this is something that's occurred in cities across the U.S. and really anywhere where a city is on the water, which is obviously many cities, the city would want to grow out into that landscape. And so you see it in San Francisco with at least 3,000 acres of made land. You see it in Boston with another 5,000 acres of made land. You see it around Manhattan. So Seattle is very similar in the sense of taking tide flats and dumping material into it, first oftentimes garbage and other debris, and then later sediment behind some sort of barricade to raise the land level up. So that's common, happens throughout. But what makes Seattle unusual are these regrades. And I think of the regrades in two ways. There's the little r regrades, and these are changes to the landscape where you take a street that maybe roller coasters along and smooth it out, fill in the low points, chop off the high points. And then what Seattle's differences are the big R regrades, and these are where you take a vast extent of land and alter it. So with Denny Hill, we're talking 11 million cubic yards of material that's removed. A hill about half the size of Capitol Hill, elevation-wise, just imagine taking that, lopping it all off, and washing it all away.
Let's go into more detail then about each of the individual projects and start with filling in the Duwamish tide flats. What was the goal of filling in the tide flats? You've alluded a bit to this already, but
yeah, Diane, twofold. One was to create flat land. And if we think of Seattle, when the first settlers arrived, the shoreline that now along the Seattle waterfront is fairly level, because that's all made land, would have been steep bluffs. And then this big open flat area of the tide flats. And so that's one part. And the second is to get trains across. And it really starts on May 1st, 1874, when Seattleites, basically the entire city, roughly 900 of the 1,000 people who live here, gather south of town, just sort of south of the Spokane Street Bridge now, to start building a railroad. A year earlier, Seattle had received a telegram saying that it would not be the terminus of the Northern Pacific Railway. And Seattle, as we all know, is, I guess, we're upstart and we get upset when people say we can't do things. So the Seattle spirit begins and everyone says, well, we're going to build our own railroad. And it may not go across the country, but it's at least going to go to Walla Walla. So everyone gathers to build this railroad. They start clearing land south. And then eventually, about a year and a half later, build this train trestle across the tide flats. And that's really the first, what I call the first skeleton or the first scaffolding to filling in the tide flats, because Seattleites realized they could cross the tide flats. They build several other trestles across. And then in 1895, you have the big change. And that's when a man named Eugene Semple, former territorial governor, decides to fill in the tide flats. And what he does is he has a machine, a dredger, that is basically a large vacuum cleaner, if you will. And he sinks this tube into the sediment of Elliott Bay, into the tide flats, and starts sucking out that material, sends it through a pipe, and deposits all that sediment behind a barrier that's been built onto the tide flats. So as you dump material behind the barrier, layer after layer after layer, and eventually raise that land to about 2 feet above high tide line. And they did this across the entire tide flats, one space at a time after another, eventually creating about, as I said, about 2,500 acres of new land. They also do it along the waterfront behind the seawall. And that's really the first big change, and literally started within probably a few years after the first settlers arrive here in 1852, and continues all the way up until the teens. By about 1917, about 90-some-odd% of the tide flats had been filled.
Would you say more about the other materials that were used as fill?
A good question. As I said, the initial material could best be described as garbage. What would happen is they would build a dock or a pier out into the water, into the tide flats, and then just start dumping material off that pier. And where it first starts is in fact, a little bit before that even, is dumping sawdust. Seattle's first industry is Henry Esler's sawmill. And the story goes is a man named Dutch Ned took a wheelbarrow, filled it with sawdust, and dumped it behind the mill and slowly started to raise the land that was around the mill. Other people followed. They put construction debris, wood, coal, garbage, charcoal, fire debris, you name it, it went into the tide flats initially. So when they do core samples and look down there, it's this sort of stew of garbage, and some of it's decomposing, which is part of the reason we have certain issues in Seattle. So garbage was really key initially, and Seattle, again, wasn't alone. Everybody did it. We should just be fortunate we're not Chicago, which had the big meatpacking industry, and the garbage they used were often carcasses and such. So we only had garbage. We didn't have as bad of things as some places.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is David Williams, author of the book Too High and Too Steep, Reshaping Seattle's Topography. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What benefits did filling in the tide flats bring?
A couple-fold. One, obviously, as I said, is creating new land. The other, it's sort of interesting, and it's less in the tide flats and more sort of along the shoreline area, is before the area of what would be west of Front Street or First Avenue was filled in, what we now think of as the Alaskan Way area, before that was filled in, there were a series of train trestles that ran along the waterfront. And as people dumped garbage underneath those, it was a good area to attract rats. And Seattle actually had plague in the city because of that. And so by filling in the area of the shoreline and underneath these railroad trestles, it prevented rats from being in that area. So it was an odd sort of benefit, is that it kept the plague away or removed it from Seattle.
What were the downsides of filling in the tide flats?
The big downsides are severalfold. One, when they did this, they paid no attention to what the Native Americans had done in this landscape. The tide flats had been a very important source of food for them. You have 2,000 acres of land where fish and all sorts of different animals and plants could be in that landscape. And so ecologically is probably the main downside from a historical point of view. From a modern point of view, the big problem with the tide flats is that the material that was dumped in, the sediment and the garbage, is not the most stable material. So many people know during the last earthquake, the 2001 Nisqually quake, you had sand boils or almost sand geysers down there. So as that sand gets shaken during an earthquake, it starts to liquefy, sort of like if you're at a beach and standing on the sand and you sort of shake up and down, you can get it to turn to liquid. Same thing happens in that landscape. So the area of the tide flats, which includes areas such as under the stadiums and Harbor Island, have a tendency to liquefy during earthquakes, which obviously can be pretty damaging. We've been fortunate. We've had three earthquakes and not had a huge amount of liquefaction. It helps that we don't have large buildings down there, too.
Now let's go on to altering the lakes. In what ways have Seattleites replumbed or altered the lakes in our area?
Well, severalfold. Lake Union and Lake Washington are the big ones. Lake Union received its name in 1854 when Thomas Mercer suggested the idea of linking Lake Washington to Puget Sound or Elliott Bay via Lake Union. And this project finally happens in 1916 and 17 with the completion of the Ship Canal and what are now known as the Hiram M. Chittenden Locks or the Ballard Locks. Doing that was significant because to make it work, they had to lower Lake Washington, which was about 9 feet above Lake Union, and then raise up the area of Salmon Bay. If you think of what modern-day Salmon Bay, it's basically a lake at this point or a reservoir behind the locks. Historically, it would have been, again, another tide flat where water came in and out during the day. So Salmon Bay is raised up, Lake Washington's lowered. And when Lake Washington is lowered, you have several changes. One, you eliminate almost all of the wetlands along the lake. About 90% of the wetlands are eliminated. And even more significantly, you change the drainage of the lake. Lake Washington historically flowed out south through Renton via the Black River, which connected to the Duwamish, which connected to Elliott Bay. And now it flows out through the Ship Canal. So when the lake lowered, it dropped below its mouth. So the Black River dries up. And what this means is severalfold. One is you have less change in the lake over time, but then what do the fish do? The migrating fish that had moved up and down the Black River into Lake Washington had to figure out a new way to get into the lake. They eventually figure it out, but it was a significant ecological change. And again, also a very significant change for the native people who had lived along the Black River and migrated and moved up through that corridor for several thousand years.
What was the economic effect of altering the lakes?
The big economic effect was, in a way, opening up the east side of Lake Washington. So prior to that, the only route out of the lake is through the Black River, and there had been a very small boat building industry on the east side of the lake prior to the lowering. But when it's lowered and you have this very good access out, you have a large boat building industry that develops in Kirkland, and that becomes very significant for the development of Kirkland. You also have, oddly enough, the establishment of the last or one of the last whaling stations in the United States in what's now Maidenbower Bay. Historically, a small fleet of boats had been out at Westport, out on the coast. And when the lake gets lowered, the owner of the whaling ships realizes that it would be better to have his boats overwinter in Lake Washington. So for about 8 months of the year, you had a whaling fleet based out of Lake Washington. They would leave for the summer, go whale up in Alaska, and come back here. But again, a significant economic contributor to the Bellevue economy, which prior to World War II really did not exist except for the whaling industry there.
Did altering the lakes benefit Seattle overall?
I often think about that question. And another way to think about it, Diane, is could we have developed without building the locks? Could we have had industrial development? And I don't know the answer to that. Salmon Bay is very significant in modern times because of the base of the Alaska Fleet. And you probably could not have had the Alaska Fleet based here because it would have been in salt water and in an area with this tidal fluctuation. And then, again, the boat building industry was pretty significant. So overall, you would probably say yes. I mean, what didn't develop, one of the initial impetuses for the canal system was actually to have Lake Washington or Lake Union be a Navy port. And that obviously did not happen. So it didn't go exactly as forecast, it hoped, but certainly from a non-commercial point of view, in terms of recreational point of view, the locks obviously are significant in opening up that connection to the east side of Seattle.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is David Williams, author of the book Too High and Too Steep, Reshaping Seattle's Topography. Now, the Denny Regrade proposal, why was this proposed?
Denny Regrade, yes, certainly the most famous and certainly the most picturesque of all the regrades in Seattle, all the topographic changes in Seattle. As I said, regrades had started early in terms of straightening out roads. And again, the driver was economics. So the title of the book, Too High and Too Steep, really sums it up. It comes from a quote from the Harvard Business Review in the early 1930s in reference to Denny Hill. The author wrote, "The hill was too high and too steep, so inevitably the hill had to be removed." And the idea being that it was in the way of commerce. If we think of Seattle, the city starts down Pioneer Square, so that's the first center of business and industry. And that slowly moves north up 1st, 2nd, and 3rd Avenues that we all know. And then it's continuing north until it gets to about Pine or to about Stewart Street. And it had been a gentle incline up to that point. And Denny Hill, at that point, is in the way. It rises 100 feet in about a block from Stewart Street. And so it was perceived that business could not climb this hill. It was in the way. It was literally too high and too steep. So the proposal was that they should eliminate it and make it so that you have a nice flat terrain to the north. And the other line that people use is that business would now be able to flow into its natural channels if this hill was removed.
What was the political process leading to the regrading?
So it's an interesting story how the regrades work. And it was driven actually by the people who lived on the hill. So the first regrade is in 1897, and it's along First Avenue. And it really sets the stage for all the subsequent regrades. Certainly, there was outside forces being the famous Seattle city engineer, Reginald Thompson, who was pushing for this process to occur. But what had to happen is that 50% of the people who lived in a specific area that was going to be regraded would have to sign a petition. And once they signed that petition, it would then go to the city council, which would pass an ordinance, which would then define the scope of the regrade. The city council would then pass another ordinance, which would define how they would pay for this project. And the thing that I think most people don't realize, and I certainly never realized until I started looking into it, is that the regrades were not paid for by the city. They were paid for by the individuals who lived on the property. So they would contract out with a contractor to remove the land. So the way it worked is the city would pass this local improvement district. They would assess the value of the land. So would someone benefit by lowering the hill? How much would they lose? That money was then paid into the city, which would then control the regrade of just the city streets. So they were responsible for all the city property. The landowner was then responsible for the property that they lived on. So they would then pay the contractor, who at the same time that they were lowering the street would lower the person's property. And the idea was that by lowering the land, the homeowner would benefit because the land would be more valuable and they would hence later be able to sell the land. That was always the dream, and that's what was always held out as why to do each of the regrades.
How was the process done physically?
There were five regrades of Denny Hill. Most people think of it as two. There were two really big ones. But in each of the first four, primarily it was water, or what are known as hydraulic cannons or hydraulic giants. And these were very simple machines, if you will. The technology had been developed during the gold rush. You take water and start it in a large pipe and feed it through subsequently smaller pipes, shoot it out a nozzle at the end, and wash away the hill. And this gets back almost to your first question, Diane, is what makes Seattle unusual? And it's this glacial sediment that Denny Hill was made out of. So it's very soft, relatively easy to wash away with water. They also supplemented it with lots of dynamite. So water and dynamite, and then all that material gets washed through some sort of flume system out into Elliott Bay, which is where Denny Hill is right now.
What was the net result of the Denny Hill regrade for the city?
Initially, it created a great series of parking lots. You can see early photos, and that's what's going on there. But industry very slowly moves into that area. We see a number of hotels go up. Oddly enough, what we see is part of the film storage industry went into this area. Early days, films were very explosive, the material they were made out of. And so they would come to a central building that had a safe vault, and distributors would come around, look at the films on these places, and then take them out. And so the film storage industry develops there, the hotel industry, and then the automobile industry gets into this area, mostly through car garages. But in a way, the promise of Denny Hill, the removal and the regrade, really does not come about until the 2000s, and you see the development of the Denny regrade area. So in many ways, it was a complete, I wouldn't say a complete failure, but it did not meet the goals. Industry did not flow into its natural channels, at least not for 70 years.
Would you underscore how the changes we've made in topography have been important to the development of Seattle as a city?
Severalfold. One is that they created an area for industry, which was critical. They opened up lanes of travel, if you will, and allowed people in the city to connect better and move through the landscape better. One of the challenges we all still experience in Seattle is how do you get from point A to point B? And the regrades and filling in the tide flats made that process much easier. So it made it more easy to move through the landscape. It gave areas for the industry to develop. And we're also seeing areas in the ship canal where industry also moves in. So in many ways, each of the projects eventually meets its goal. You could also argue that they were ecological problems that we're still dealing with. And I also think the other aspect of it is, in a way of sort of more philosophical, it's the mindset that's created in Seattle that in order for us to deal with our topography, it means we have to alter the landscape. And that's still going on to this day. We still see that in projects such as the State Route 99 tunnel, the building of the seawall. It's this connection to land that we need to change the land over time.
Where in the city can you currently see vestiges of former Seattle topography? What are some examples?
One of my favorite odd little spots is at First and Virginia, which is now the high point of Denny Hill. And if you stand at that point, you look down in all directions. And that's because of a big battle over movement of land. The idea would have been to lower that area more. So you can see a little bit of odd topographic relief there. You can see it. Where I like to point it out is sort of see the change is actually from some of the high points and looking down on this very flat landscape that we have that's very unnatural. So anytime you see flat land in Seattle, you should think you're seeing something unnatural. And then a final way, and this is one that we've been dealing with of late, is in these areas of fill, particularly the early areas of fill where there was all this garbage deposited, and you see subsidence taking place. So walk through Pioneer Square, and you'll see that the sidewalks are tilted because the land is settling. You see buildings where if you walk along the base of it from one end to the next, one end's a little bit lower. You see it underground in buildings where when the tide changes, you'll sometimes have buildings where they get flooded in the basement, maybe a few inches of water. And again, that's because we've altered this landscape so much. And we still feel that. What they're experiencing right now is the building of the new Weyerhaeuser building in downtown Seattle in Pioneer Square. And that area where it's being built used to be a marsh, a tidal marsh, filled with all sorts of garbage and such. And so to do that, they're going to have to shore up a lot of that area. Some of you may remember there used to be a parking lot right there. And if you looked in the parking lot, the cars were always sort of catawampus to each other because that land is settling and still settles in that area.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I guess the sort of bigger message gets back to earlier. If you think about the people who came to Seattle, they were incredibly ambitious. They came here with this idea that they were going to make Seattle into a great city. And if it meant changing the landscape, they would. And that became part of our DNA. And we still think that way. But what's different now is that we worry that the landscape is going to change us because of our understanding of the geologic issues. So it's still part of who we are. We want to change the land, but the land is also changing us.
Well, thanks so much for being here, David.
My pleasure.
You were just listening to David Williams, author of the book Too High and Too Steep, Reshaping Seattle's Topography, published in 2015 by the University of Washington Press. For more information, check on the web at geologywriter.com. You are invited to join David for the launch of his book, Too High and Too Steep, on September 9th, 7 p.m. at the University Bookstore. Again, September 9th, 7 p.m. at the University Bookstore. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.